You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. In November 2018, a young man vanished into the gray sea night, stepping across the forbidden line that separated two worlds. His name was John Allen Chow, 26 years old, an American with a quiet resolve, a missionary's conviction burning in his chest. He sailed toward North Sentinel Island, a place sealed off from the modern world, where the Sentinelese have refused all contact for centuries. But he wasn't a tourist. He saw himself as a messenger with a message no one else dared deliver. He carried in his pack a waterproof Bible, gifts, hopes, and a deep certainty that he would either be welcomed or die trying. What followed is part tragedy, part mystery. The fishermen who dropped him off claimed they saw islanders dragging a body across the sand and a burial at dusk. But exactly what happened in the hours between his arrival and his death, no one knows. His body was never recovered. Was he a martyr, a fool, a man haunted by divine urgency, or someone who crossed the ultimate boundary between the known and the unknowable and paid the price? We'll retrace his footsteps, the years of planning, the journal entries scribbled in darkness, the journey into the Forbidden Lagoon, and the final fateful moment when a remote tribe drew its bow. This is more than a story about death. It's a story of faith, obsession, and the fatal cost of conviction. All in the name of Jesus. Before we can understand what happened to John, we have to understand the world he was walking into. North Sentinel Island isn't just remote. It's practically sealed off from time itself. A tiny speck in the Bay of Bengal, surrounded by reefs and stormy waters. It's part of India's Andaman Islands, but in reality, it's a place few outsiders have ever seen up close. The people who live there are among the last uncontacted tribes on Earth. They've survived in isolation for tens of thousands of years, rejecting every attempt at contact with the outside world. Helicopters, boats, even gifts dropped from above, all met with the same warning. Arrows drawn, ready to defend their home. To them, every visitor is an invader. To the outside world, they're a mystery. People who've managed to preserve their way of life in a modern age that no longer allows for secrets. So when John set out for North Sentinel Island, he wasn't just traveling to a forbidden place. He was stepping into one of the last untouched corners of human history. The Sentinelese on North Sentinel Island are almost entirely beyond history's gaze. They move like shadows, emerge briefly on the white beaches, then fade into the deep, alive forest. Their drums and arrows are all that most outsiders ever glimpse, and almost nothing else is known with certainty. North Sentinel Island is a place sealed off not just by geography, but by a kind of human boundary. A boundary that has never been crossed by consent. So, what do we know about this island and these people? North Sentinel Island is part of the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, and Indian Territory in the Bay of Bengal. The island itself is dense jungle, coral reefs surrounding it, battered by monsoon rains and waves. It's remote, about 31 miles west of Port Blair, the administrative capital of the Andaman Islands. The Sentinelese are classified by the Indian government as a particularly vulnerable tribal group. Because of their isolation and lack of immunity to many diseases, Indian law protects them. Contact is off-limits, and laws prevent outsiders from coming closer than 5 nautical miles to the island. Estimating how many Sentinelese there are is nearly impossible. The 2011 Indian census put the number at 15 to 12 males and 3 females. But even census officials say that number is a guess based on distant observation. Other estimates by anthropologists and observers suggest the real number could range from 40 to 500, or more conservatively, between 50 and 150. What we do know about the Sentinelese comes mostly from what we don't know. The truth about who they are and where they came from is shrouded in mystery, wrapped in myth, and buried beneath centuries of isolation. From a distance, their dark skin and strong builds led some to believe they were African, direct descendants of the first humans who left the cradle of humankind tens of thousands of years ago. The theory goes that, like other ancient tribes of the Andamans, their ancestors once walked across a land bridge that connected Myanmar. And when the last ice age ended and sea levels rose, those mountains became islands, cutting them off from the rest of the world. It's a haunting story. The image of a people marooned in time, still living as their ancestors once did. To some anthropologists, it's a scientific marvel. To some believers, a miracle. Adam and Eve, untouched, living as God created them. But even the most romantic theories come with questions that may never be answered. There's no way to know for certain how long the Sentinelese have lived there, or exactly when the sea closed around their island. No bones have been unearthed, no DNA sampled, no artifacts studied. Their entire history remains unspoken. Their language, their legends, their origin story, known only to them. Everything we think we know comes from a distance, from the eyes of those watching through binoculars, or from the hum of a helicopter hovering offshore. It's a reminder that when it comes to the Sentinelese, every fact we hold on to is surrounded by shadows. Sure, we can guess at their beginnings, we can map their island, but who they are, how they see the world, remains one of humanity's last great mysteries. They live as hunter-gatherers, just as their ancestors did for thousands of years. They fish in the shallow lagoons, hunt small animals in the forest, and gather fruit and honey from the dense jungle. Sometimes they wade into the surf, spearing fish with sharpened wooden tips or simple bows, tools crafted by hand and passed down through generations. Observers from afar have seen their small huts, palm frond roofs open on the sides to the breeze, and fires glowing deep within the trees at night. They've seen canoes carved from hollow logs, used to glide along the shallows, never far from shore. Everything they build, everything they use, comes from the island itself. There are no roads, no metal, no electricity, no written language that we know of. And yet, to them, their world is whole, complete. A place where the sea provides, the forest shelters, and outsiders are not just unwelcome, but unthinkable. They live without the trappings of modern civilization, but they aren't primitive. They're independent. Every attempt to civilize the Andaman tribes in the past has brought disease, displacement, and death. The Sentinelese know this, instinctively or through ancient memory. So their hostility isn't cruelty, it's survival. Because their immune systems have never been exposed to the viruses and bacteria the rest of us live with. Even a single cold could wipe out their entire population. And that's why the Indian government enforces a strict ban against visitors. Instead, authorities maintain what they call an eyes-on, hands-off policy, watching from a distance to keep poachers away. but leaving the Sentinelese to live as they always have, in peace and in secrecy. There's something about the Sentinelese that both fascinates us and chills us to the bone. Maybe it's because they are, in so many ways, the last of their kind, a living echo of a world that existed long before ours. People who've never seen a car, never heard a phone ring, never touched a coin or read a word. Their lives are untouched by technology, by global politics, by everything we think of as progress. They're a reminder that even now, in the 21st century, there are still places where the map simply ends. But it's not just the mystery of their existence that captures us. It's what they represent. They're proof that humanity can exist outside the noise, outside the web, outside us. When we look at the Sentinelese, we see more than an isolated tribe. We see a mirror, a reflection of what we've lost connection to. The land, community, simplicity. But we also see what terrifies us. The idea that we don't belong everywhere. That there are boundaries, even in our age of conquest and curiosity, that we're not meant to cross. Their story forces us to confront uncomfortable questions. What does it mean to be left alone? What right do we have to intrude on another people's world, even in the name of discovery or faith or good intention? And at what point does curiosity become a violation? For centuries, explorers have tried to reach every corner of the planet. But here, on this tiny island, a few dozen people have drawn a line in the sand and defended it for thousands of years. In all those thousands of years, the message from the Sentinelese has always been clear. Stay away. John Allen Chau decided that warning did not apply to him. John believed he'd been chosen to bring the word of God to one of the last uncontacted peoples on Earth. In his eyes, he wasn't breaking the law. He was fulfilling divine purpose. But what he couldn't see, or refused to see, was that his mission would not risk just his own life, but the survival of an entire population. So let's learn who John Allen Chau really was, the man behind the mission, and what drove him to believe he had the right to invade such a society. John was born on December 18, 1991, in Scottsboro, Alabama, the youngest of three children in a family whose roots traced across continents and convictions. His mother was Linda Adams Chau, a European-American organizer with a Christian fellowship, and his father, Patrick Chau, a Chinese-American psychiatrist who'd left mainland China during the Cultural Revolution. Together, they created a home in Vancouver, Washington, where John would grow up. At Vancouver Christian High School, a small, tight-knitted school of just 90 students spanning seven grades, that's where John found his world. It was a place where faith and friendship, discipline and curiosity were lived daily. He was raised in the Assemblies of God tradition, Pentecostal, vibrant, spoken in tongues at times, grounded in the conviction that faith was not idle, but rather it was active. From childhood onward, his two passions burned side by side in him. One was the wilderness of the outdoors, hiking rugged trails, camping beneath the stars, devouring survival stories like Hatchet by Gary Paulsen, about a boy forced to live off the land in the Alaskan wilderness. The other was the call of Jesus Christ, immediate, personal, and urgent. He came to count explorers and missionaries as heroes. The naturalist John Muir, the missionary explorer David Livingstone, the Christian adventurer Bruce Olson. They represented to him something far more than history. They were models of a life lived at the edge, of faith and of the world. In high school, his interest in outdoor adventure merged with his faith in an uncommon way. He became intrigued, even captivated, by the idea of bringing Christianity to the remote. He learned of the isolated tribe on North Sentinel Island, and from that moment, he began to believe that his purpose would take him there. And John was, by nearly every account, a high achiever. In the Royal Rangers, a Pentecostal scouting-style organization, he earned the Gold Medal of Achievement, a rank comparable to Eagle Scout. One requirement was reading or listening to the entire Bible. He threw himself into clubs, charities, extracurriculars. He loved hiking, camping, travel, and was meticulous in documenting his explorations on social media. On Facebook and Instagram, you can trace a young man who believed the wilderness was his classroom, and that each mountain, each river, each trial was a sermon in motion. When he went to college, he chose Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. At ORU, he managed the university's soccer team and graduated cum laude in 2014 with a Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science. The university itself was deeply immersed in evangelical culture. No smoking, no drinking, no swearing, no sexual relations outside heterosexual marriage. John absorbed this environment wholeheartedly. His missionary trips began in earnest. Mexico in high school in 2008. Then South Africa, Iraq, Turkey, and other parts of the world. On those trips, he said things like, "We can't be lukewarm. We need to know how to defend our faith. When we go out in our world, there are people that'll come and oppose us." And those were words that framed his mindset. He opted not to chase conventional careers or romantic entanglements. He believed it was irresponsible given the risks of his intended mission. Instead, he pursued wilderness training. He did the National Outdoor Leadership School course, trained as an EMT, spent summers working as a ranger and emergency nurse in places like Whiskeytown National Recreation Area in California. Living alone in a small cabin, he crafted his life state for what he believed was coming. His social media reveals a rugged man, fit and purposeful, hiking steep trails, paddling remote waters, and capturing vivid photographs of nature. He was even approached by a beef jerky company as an influencer, a hint at his social media pull. But still, his gaze was fixed forward, to the unreached, the remote, the last place on Earth. His preparations grew more specific. He first traveled to the Andaman Islands in 2015 and 2016, though not yet North Sentinel Island itself. He took 4 trips in total to the region. In 2017, he participated in missionary boot camp training with the Kansas City-based evangelical group All Nations. The training included navigating a mock native village populated by missionary staff, pretending to be hostile natives with fake spears. It was part of his preparation for what he believed would be his mission. In his own diary, he referred to the tribe as his burden. He prepared gifts, mapping of the island, survival gear, linguistics training, even medical equipment, because he believed that the people on North Sentinel had never heard the gospel and never seen the love of Jesus. His decision to travel to North Sentinel Island was not impulsive. It was premeditated. He knew the legal status. The island was off limits, protected by Indian law because of the Sentinelese's isolation and vulnerability to disease. He knew the risk to himself and to them, yet he believed the mission was worth any cost. Standing now at the edge of our story, we know the mission that consumed him. His quiet prayers, his rugged gear, his long preparation, the wilderness mapped both outside and within. The son, the brother, the friend, a humble figure avoiding romantic entanglements for a higher cause. The anxious young man with a Bible in one hand and a mountain trail in the other. And that brings us to the point that he arrives to North Sentinel Island. In October 2018, John stood on the edge of his calling. He traveled to the Andaman and Nicobar Islands on a tourist visa and established his base in Port Blair. From this place of relative modernity, internet cafes, government offices, luggage racks, and ferry docks, he prepared his route into nearly absolute isolation. Now, he never asked for permission for the end destination. He just chose it. In Port Blair, he assembled what he called his initial contact kit. picture cards to communicate without a shared language, bandages, and dental forceps for removing the kinds of injuries he anticipated, which were arrows or spears, and gifts for the tribe, tweezers, scissors, cord, safety pins, fish hooks. He believed these simple implements, unfamiliar to the Sentinelese, might break the ice and perhaps show goodwill rather than confrontation. In an act to protect the people he planned to reach, the tribe whose very genetic makeup had never been exposed to modern diseases, John entered a self-imposed quarantine. For 11 days, he avoided direct sunlight, lived indoors, exercised, prayed, read missionary biographies such as The Lives of the Three Mrs. Judsons, which is a 19th century Christian account. He believed that if he carried no containment, no unseen virus or bacteria, he would reduce the risk to them. Late in the night of November 14th, he and a couple of Christian fishermen, the only men willing to ferry him, though aware of the risks, set out under the cover of darkness. They slipped quietly away, avoiding the Indian Coast Guard vessels. The sea around them flickered with bioluminescent plankton, trailing light like ghostly paths as the skiff cut through the water. John later wrote that fish jumped around them like darting mermaids. They anchored near North Sentinel Island in the pitch black. The world of the island seemed still and impenetrable at that hour. The next morning, November 15th, John made his first approach. He told the fishermen to stay 500 to 700 meters from shore. Then, stripping down to his underwear, believing that less clothing might make him seem more vulnerable and less threatening, more human to the unknown watchers, he paddled a kayak toward the beach, carrying his waterproof Bible. He saw what looked like huts, dugout canoes resting in the sand. As he drew nearer, a group of Sentinelese emerged. Faces painted yellow, bodies fit, languages spoken in high-pitched sounds, movement rapid and guarded. He called out, "My name is John, I love you, and Jesus loves you." The greeting hung in the air. The islanders responded by stringing their bows. Heart pounding, John panicked. He threw toward them the fish he had brought, a gift. Then, according to his diary, turned and paddled like he never had in his life. But he didn't stop. Later that same day, he returned. This time, he landed on the beach. He laid out more gifts and approached the hut from earlier, staying just beyond the arrow range. A half dozen Sentinelese emerged, whooping and shouting. He tried to mimic their words, but they burst out laughing. He believed they were insulting him. He concluded they must be saying bad words. He sang worship songs, preached from Genesis. And for a moment, the tension seemed to ease. Then a boy shot an arrow. The arrow struck his waterproof Bible, piercing the faith he carried in his hand. He pulled it out, handed it back to the boy, and retreated. The Sentinelese had taken his kayak, so he swam nearly a mile back to the fishing vessel. That night, he wrote in his journal, "I'm scared, watching the sunset, and it's beautiful." He wept a bit and wondered if it would be the last sunset he saw before the place where the sun never sets. He wrote to his family, "You guys might think I'm crazy in all this, but I think it's worth it to declare Jesus to these people." He asked God, "Is this Satan's last stronghold, a place where none have heard or even had a chance to hear your name?" Undeterred, he prepared for the next attempt, going alone, away from the boat, believing that appearing without a vessel might make less threat. And he accepted the possibility of dying. He wrote, "I think I could be more useful alive, but to you, God, I give all the glory of whatever happens." He asked forgiveness for any of the people on this island who try to kill him, especially if they succeed. Shortly after dawn on November 16th, the last day he was seen alive, John requested the fishermen drop him off alone. The decision was intentional. He instructed them to leave. He knew the risk, but in his mind, the souls of the tribe outweighed his life. The following day, the fishermen watched from their boat in stunned silence. On the distant shoreline, they saw several tribesmen dragging what appeared to be a body across the sand, then digging a shallow grave and covering it. Realizing what had happened, they turned their boat toward Port Blair and reported the grim sight to the authorities. Later, they returned with the police to the same stretch of beach, pointing out the place where they believed John's body now lay, buried beneath the island's white sand. Absolutely nothing is known about what happened in those final moments. Between the time John stepped onto the sand of the North Sentinel Island and the moment the fishermen saw his body dragged across the beach. No one but the Sentinelese know how it ended, and they'll never tell. When the fishermen returned to Port Blair, they carried with them not just the weight of what they had witnessed, but also John's waterproof diary, the last record of his thoughts and fears, his faith and determination. They handed it to a local friend of John's, a fellow Christian preacher living in the capital. That friend, trembling as he turned its pages, contacted John's family in the United States. And soon after, the U.S. consulate in Chennai was notified. And on November 19th, word reached the Andaman authorities. Within 2 days, the story had spread across the world. On November 21st, the Director General of Police released a statement reminding the public that North Sentinel Island was strictly off-limits. A protected zone where no one, not even researchers or rescue teams, could legally go without risking both infection and death. Still, Indian officials tried. They launched several recovery efforts, approaching the island by boat, circling at a distance, scanning the shore through binoculars. But the Sentinelese made their intentions clear. Each time, they emerged from the tree line with bows drawn, arrows poised, their message unmistakable: leave us alone. On one occasion, officials used binoculars and telephoto lenses to search the beach for any sign of John's body. But it had already vanished beneath the shifting sand. The government finally decided to halt all recovery operations. To continue, they said, would risk another death and possibly expose the tribe to modern pathogens that could devastate them. Dr. A.K. Sharma, an anthropologist who advised on the case, told The Guardian that the danger of a violent clash was simply too high to justify further attempts. "We have to respect their isolation. It's what keeps them alive." And so, John Allen Chow remains on that forbidden island, buried in the sand of the very place he believed God had sent him. His body was never brought home, his grave marked only by the rhythm of the tide. In death, John became both martyr and cautionary tale, a symbol of faith unshaken and of boundaries fatally crossed. His final journey ended where human history itself may have begun, on an island, untouched by time, where the past still breathes and outsiders do not belong. So, who's to blame? There's no single answer, no neat resolution. In the life and death of John, the fault lines spread outward, into his own heart, into a faith community, into an exotic and isolated people, into the modern world's impulses of redemption and intrusion. On one level, John himself stands at the center. He chose to go. He knowingly breached the forbidden buffer zone surrounding the Sentinelese people's territory. He acknowledged the risks of disease, of collision, of death. He wrote in his journal that if he died, the glory still belonged to God. He accepted the possibility. His mission was essential in his own reckoning, his vision permanent. And yet, in making that choice, he stepped across a boundary that was neither mutual nor sanctioned. Then there's the tribe, the Sentinelese. The islanders are not innocent in the sense of being blameless ghosts, but they did not ask for contact. They've made it clear their wish to be left alone. To intrude on them is to trespass into a world guarded as fiercely as the sea around it. For them, John's arrival was not a gift, perhaps not even an offer, but an act of intrusion, with all the danger that implies. Is John's religion to blame? Evangelical faith, its zeal for the unreached? They carry with it ideas of obligation, of sacred commission, of sacrifice. John believed he was fulfilling the Great Commission. Less visible, perhaps, is the burden it placed on him and the weight of the doctrine that spurred him onward. Was faith the flame that lifted him or the fire that consumed him? And what of the missionary network, the organization that trained him, sent him, commended his decision? All Nations International celebrated John's life, calling him a martyr. They emphasized his preparation, his love, his gifts. The privilege of sharing the gospel has often involved great cost, said their leader. And yet critics noted how All Nations International framed him not only as courageous, but expected to give his life. The missionary community thus enters as part of the responsibility, not only in what they did, but how they framed and glorified the act. Consider also the voice of Survival International, which criticized John's journey not just for its danger to him, but for the far greater risk posed to all the Sentinelese people. They warned that the isolated tribe lacked immunity to outside pathogens. Even if John survived, the arrival of disease could extinguish an entire culture. They declared that this tragedy should never have been allowed to happen. In their view, the moral fault lay not in an isolated individual act, but in failing systems of protection, the laws, the governments, the international safeguards that might have prevented the encounter. And John's father offered his own indictment. He blamed the missionary community for implanting his son in extreme Christianity and pushing him to an end he sensed as inevitable. He said, "John is gone because the Western ideology overpowered my influence." The man who raised a young son to love God and creation now saw him lost to a version of faith that asked too much. There's also the question of the state machine, the Indian government, its buffer zone policy, its enforcement of a hands-off, eyes-on regime toward the Sentinelese. Some scholars pointed out that legal charges of murder in John's case were problematic, given the absence of objective facts about the community and their rights. Rather, that the tragedy should serve as a warning to strengthen the protection regime to prevent further exploitation and misunderstanding. So in the end, blame is not a single arrow. It fractures into many shards. The idealism of one young man, the doctrine that sent him, the organization that equipped him, the vulnerable people he sought to reach, and the protective systems that failed to contain the consequences. In some quarters, the verdict has been harsh. "John is not a martyr," said one exasperated social media voice. "Just a dumb American who thought the tribals needed Jesus when the tribals already lived in harmony with God and nature for years without outside interference." Others choose a softer view. He was sincere, passionate, and tragically misled. His family, in a brief Instagram post, asked the world to remember him not only as a crusader, but as a beloved son, brother, uncle, and friend who loved God, life, helping those in need, and had nothing but love for the Sentinelese people. And so we circle the question again. What exactly went wrong? Was it the ambition that reached too far? The faith that bypassed consent? The culture that believed advance meant intrusion? The state that allowed it? Or the man who believed he was invited when the invitation was never given? We'll never have just one answer. But this story holds within it a lesson, that the impulse to save can touch the impulse to dominate, that what seems service to one may look like an invasion to another, and that in our desire to help, we must first ask if we have consent, and if the cost is worth the cause. My travel tips for North Sentinel Island? Pretty simple. Don't go. Don't go. Don't try. Don't even dream about sneaking a boat close enough to glimpse a person on the shore. The Sentinelese are not a destination. They're not an adventure, a curiosity, or an untouched last tribe. They are sovereign people who have spoken their will louder than any words. They want to be left alone. The ocean around their island isn't just water. It's a boundary, one that protects them from us. Because what we bring with us, even when our hearts are pure, is danger. Not just in the form of violence, but in the invisible things, the microbes, the pathogens, the viruses that have already destroyed entire civilizations before. The indigenous rights group, Survival International, has warned that remote tribes are being wiped out by outsiders who steal their land and resources, and by diseases like flu and measles, against which they have no immunity. It's a haunting reminder that contact can be a death sentence. Even in death, John could have infected the very people he claimed he wanted to save. And that's the tragedy in all of this. He believed he was bringing life, when what he brought, what any of us would bring, is risk. The Sentinelese don't need our religion, our science, our curiosity, or our approval. They're not meant to be studied, photographed, or folded into the rest of the world. They are living history, yes. But more than that, they are living people. People who have survived centuries of storms, invasions, and colonization by doing one thing consistently, keeping their distance. So if you ever find yourself in the Andaman Islands, standing on a beach, looking out across the water toward that green shadow on the horizon, remember that some places are sacred because they're forbidden. Respect the boundary. Travel isn't always about going farther. Sometimes it's about knowing when not to go. And this? Well, this is one of those times. And remember, wherever you travel, learn the laws, respect the local cultures, protect what's sacred. Don't assume that access equals entitlement, because adventure means nothing if it erases what makes a place unique. So my travel tip for North Sentinel Island stands. Don't go. Don't disturb. Don't romanticize. Just let them live exactly as they always have. John Allen Chau's story is not one of adventure. It's not one of heroism. It's a story of faith, colliding with the boundaries of a world that should have been left untouched. When we strip away the headlines, the words missionary, martyr, tribe, isolation, what's left is a man who believed he was doing good. A man whose conviction outweighed his caution. A man who thought he was bringing salvation, but instead brought tragedy. It's easy to dismiss John as naive, arrogant, even foolish. But it's more complicated than that. He was human, deeply flawed, deeply faithful, and shaped by a system that told him his beliefs were more important than another culture's survival. And that conviction, when untempered by humility or respect, can be very dangerous. The Sentinelese didn't kill John because they were savage. They defended their home because they've always had to. For tens of thousands of years, they've resisted the tides of colonization, disease, and exploitation. And their message remains unchanged, spoken through silence, through arrows, through distance. Leave us alone. And maybe that's the hardest thing for humanity to do, to leave something truly untouched, to see something wild and ancient and not try to own it, document it, or convert it. John's death should not be remembered as a failure of courage, but as a failure to listen. Because some places are not meant to be reached. Some people are not meant to be saved. They already are, in their own way, in their own world. If there's a lesson here, it's this. Wherever we travel, whether across oceans or across cultures, we owe it to the world and to ourselves to tread lightly, to seek understanding before action, to respect before reaching. So take this as a call to action. Not to go farther, but to go wiser. Protect what's sacred, honor what's different, and never mistake curiosity for permission. Because some places are not meant to be found. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod, and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.